மாமதி மாமதி மணி மாமதி தான் திருநந்தனே மரணி தனி மணி பாபா மாம மாமதி மதேதா சதரே மாம மாமதி
ਤੇਰੂ Because I fucking look like a terrorist, apparently. And if I fucking...
It's not funny.
Yeah, I mean, but honestly, when people fucking treat you like a fucking terrorist just because you have this nose, this face, these fucking eyes and beard, that's some fucked up shit. I just warned all of you here, next time you go to an Arab shop to buy your falafel, your hummus, whatever, have a conversation with the guy. That person is a human being. It starts with you. You know, it doesn't start with my white wolf, it starts with all of us. Know what I mean? The last song is Shema Bimari, just tell us. Yeah.
Говорить о чем-то поздно. Вы обречены. Смерть Павла Кушнира и арест Дианы Логиновой – два отдельных события, но они укладываются в один нарратив. Публичное высказывание перестало быть только актом искусства и превратилось в акт гражданского сопротивления. Павел Кушнир, пианист и антивоенный активист, был арестован по обвинению в публичных призывах, держал голодовку и умер в СИЗО в июле 2024 года. Его история – демонстрация того, как отдельный голос, пусть и крошечный по охвату, может стать поводом для людоедской реакции госмашины, а после для общественного забвения. Диана Логинова, Наоко, молодая уличная исполнительница группы Stop Time, чье исполнение собрало публику в Петербурге, а видео с концерта стали вирусными. В результате ей предъявили административные протоколы за организацию несогласованного массового пребывания и за дискредитацию армии. Обвинение, которое в ряде случаев влечет не только штрафы, но и уголовную ответственность. Сейчас ей грозит реальная угроза, ее могут посадить на 7 лет, и ее соотечественники будут наблюдать за этим молча. Что общего у этих дел? В нормальном обществе исполнение песни на улице – эпизод уличной культуры. В авторитарной среде тот же акт становится угрозой общественному порядку, дискредитации или организации массовых беспорядков. Таким образом, криминализуется сама публичность несогласия. Неважно, сколько людей слушало, важно, что акт публичен. Это превращает творчество в поле риска. На практике это означает, что молодые артисты, студенты, музыканты, поэты оказываются на передовой, где штраф или арест – обычная цена за публичное высказывание. Павел Кушнир умер в следственном изоляторе после голодовки, объявленной в знак протеста против войны и репрессий. Даже если исходные обвинения оказались абсурдными или чрезмерными, ответная реакция государства, лишение медикаментозной и юридической поддержки, длительное содержание под стражей и в итоге гибель посылает мощный сигнал своему обществу. Публичная критика нас может стоить жизни вам. Это не только индивидуальная трагедия, это системное предупреждение, предназначенное для деморализации потенциальных протестующих, но и для подавления возможной солидарности, которая есть только через VPN в запрещенном Threads. Почему большинство выбирает покорность? Исторически и социологически есть несколько факторов. Для многих приоритет – сохранение работы, дохода, крыши над головой. Риск быть замеченным властями воспринимается как непозволительная роскошь. Контролируемые медиа десятилетиями в России формируют рамки допустимого, в которых альтернативные интерпретации маргинализируются. Практика наказаний, штрафы, аресты, уголовные дела создают эффект устрашения, и это работает. Но и культурная инерция, агрессивная ностальгия по прошлому – факторы, цементирующие замшелость и отсталость. Результат – широкая пассивность и адаптация к давлению. Люди выбирают холодильник и телевизор, а не риск. Это объясняет, почему масштабного сопротивления не будет в этом обществе никогда. И почему давление на отдельные акты протеста не вызывают лавинообразной ответной реакции. Поохали и разошлись. Они это знают. Они знают вашу реакцию. Ждем следующего. В Северной Корее режим держится десятилетиями благодаря комбинации информационной изоляции, репрессии и культуры подчинения. Важно заметить, Россия и КНДР – разная историческая, экономическая и социальная реальность. Тем не менее, схожая логика. Институциональное закрепление повиновения сохранится там на десятилетия, если не будет слома механизмов репрессий и если не изменится массовая политическая культура. А этого не произойдет. Это не догма, а предупреждение. Процессы трансформации могут занять поколения, и речь даже не о сегодняшних первоклассниках. Истории Павла и Дианы показывают, что цена неповиновения и вообще голоса очень высока, а солидарность в России – редкость. Вы обречены. Что можно сделать, но этого тоже не случится? Давать международную огласку случаям репрессий против творческих единиц, поддерживать их информационно, юридически, материально, тех, кто пострадал. Работать над культурными проектами, которые формируют и распространяют гражданскую солидарность противостояния от музыки до художественных и образовательных инициатив. Но ничего не получится. Значимого сопротивления не сформируется. Не питайте иллюзий. Даже за 3 года ничего не произошло. Стало только хуже. Гиблое дело и земля. Истории Павла и Дианы о цене, которую платят отдельные люди, за право говорить, они демонстрируют, что в условиях, где государство трактует творчество как угрозу, артист становится одновременно и музыкантом, и объектом политического давления, и заложником. Смерть Павла – это невозвратная потеря, уже поглощенная забвением. Задержание Дианы – предупреждение для оставшихся не рыпаться, а кланяться. Ну а вместе эти истории образуют тревожный портрет общества, где выбор большинства – подчинение. Это и делает возможными такие репрессии. И это будет продолжаться. Ну и напоследок. Поразительно, как люди умудряются жить в информационном вакууме. Именно вы, такие милые, аполитичные, ничего не знающие и не желающие знать, с полной уверенностью в своей правоте понесете никому не нужный русский мир в другие страны, если только вам прикажут. На кон поставлено все, чтобы общество оставалось невежественным и инфантильным. We'll be right back.
smoke about your urban, then me cheers out your love. Spin the smoke about your urban, then me cheers out your love. Spin the smoke about your urban, then me cheers out your love. Spin the smoke about your urban, then me cheers out your love. Spin the smoke about your urban, then me cheers out your love. Spin the smoke about your urban, then me cheers out your love. Spin the smoke about your urban, then me cheers out your love.
Go on, beat off, beat the jump right back on top.
Airing on Asheville FM 103.3 LPFM in Asheville, this is the Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Chalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from projects and struggles all around the world, and you can find our archives, transcripts, ways to follow us and support us at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. This week, we're sharing an interview with James Stout on his AK Press book, Against the State, Anarchists and Comrades at War in Spain, Myanmar, and Rojava, due out early January 2026. You may recognize James as a contributor to the Cool Zone podcast, It Could Happen Here, distributed by iHeartMedia. For this episode, we talk about the idea of anarchist armies, discuss those three conflicts I already named, left libertarian approaches to formalized armed resistance beyond the guerrilla unit, some of the novel technologies and international solidarities that have developed, and a lot more. You can check our show notes for links to other places you can find James's work. So would you please introduce yourself for the audience with any name, pronouns, affiliations, or other details that you want to share for this conversation?
Yeah, sure. Nice to be here. My name is James Stout. I use he, him pronouns. Relevant affiliations for this. I work for Cool Zone Media. People have probably, if they've heard of me, that's where they've heard of me. I suppose the other relevant affiliations for this one would be that I've spent time with rebels fighting against a Burmese junta, with the Kurdish Freedom Movement, and doing a lot of mutual aid and reporting along the so-called border between Mexico and the United States.
Cool. Yeah, thank you so much for having this conversation and for writing this book and being willing to talk to me about it. I much appreciate it. So yeah, we're here to talk about the upcoming AK Press title, or it might be actually released by the time this comes out, but that you authored and titled Against the State, Anarchists and Comrades at War in Spain, Myanmar, and Rojava. You mentioned like spending time with rebels in various situations, but talk about your journalistic and academic background that provides the groundwork for this book and why you chose to write on these subjects.
Yeah, certainly. So academically, I did a PhD in what is, they call it modern European history, right? But my interest was specifically in the Spanish Revolution and more specifically in the Catalan Revolution, and more specifically in the use of sports and physical culture to create an anti-fascist identity within that revolution. And I had always been very interested, I guess, in the way that anarchism played into conflict, right? Because you have this big debate within the CNT going into the civil war and the years before it, being like, how do we prepare for this? Like, and especially, like, you know, as they have this moment in the early republic, right, where they do have uprisings and they do secure liberty very briefly, and then they get crushed. And then you have this moments before the republic where they are fighting, but it's like, during my undergraduate, we were allowed to do a dissertation. Because of the place I did my undergraduate, it's a very old university. You can upgrade that to a master's if you want. Not something I'm particularly concerned with. But I wrote about violence in the Catalan Builders Union, and I wrote about armed violence there. So I was interested, right, in this. Generally, anarchists have been opposed to war. They've seen it and denounced it as a racket, and with very good reason. And I don't think that anything I've written or said in this book should ever lose count of that, and I tried to be very clear about that throughout the text. But I was interested in how they met it. And then I was reading some other stuff, you know, I'm reading Graeber and these things, and seeing there's this line in The New Anarchist where they say, like, essentially, like, conflict is a domain of state communism and always will be, right? Like, that we have to cede the ground of warfare to the Stalinists. And I just thought that was odd, because if we believe that people can organize themselves and that people don't need to be compelled through violence from the state, you know, to do good things, to do the right thing, which is kind of the sine qua non of what anarchism is, why don't we think they can organize themselves in this specific place? Why is it different? And that just kind of hung out in my mind for a while. And then in my reporting, I have been very interested in recent years in 3D printed firearms, because I think that they represent a significant change in the ability of the state to have a monopoly on violence. Not necessarily in this country, right, where firearms are readily accessible to most people. Not all people, of course, but to many people. But in other parts of the world, right? And so I was keeping an eye on those. And I guess as someone who's reported on a lot of conflicts, I saw all the reporting on 3D printed firearms focusing on crime in the United States. And I thought that was a lame framing, because there is a potential here for someone to liberate themselves, for someone to defend their community or another community from violence, right? And so when I saw those being used in Myanmar, that immediately became interesting to me. And so that's how I began reporting on Myanmar about 5 years ago now. And then the third element of this is a revolution in Kurdistan, which had always been very interesting to me. It was something I'd followed closely and taken a great interest in, like, both as someone who was interested in organizing and building democracy without the state, and in somebody who was interested in, like, a topic I kind of grappled with in my dissertation, was this Catalan national project, which tried to cast itself as an anti-fascist project. And ultimately, like, now, I wouldn't say, like, it's not become fascist, but there's a very conservative vision of Catalan identity, which is not compatible with a progressive one that I was interested in the 1930s. So I'm interested in how did the Kurdish freedom movement balance these things? And you know, we see the answer to that in the way that they're conducting themselves and in the writings of Öcalan, right? So those were the three areas that were of interest to me. And I've been fortunate to travel through work to all those places to talk to people. And I kept coming back to that Graeber piece and, like, thinking a lot when I was in Spain, you know, the scars of the civil war, both physically and emotionally, are very present, right? I am lucky enough to have been of the last generation probably that got to spend significant time talking to people who fought in the conflict there. And I was just always, like, thinking about their stories and their experiences. And at the time I was cycling a lot, so I'd be riding around Spain being like, there's so much here that we don't talk about. And I just felt like that little line in that little essay, it just bothered me, right? Because these people had been capable. And I think sometimes when we talk about anarchism and Spanish anarchism specifically, we do it in terms of like heroes and saints. And I don't think we should. I think we should do it in terms of people and the things they accomplished and also the mistakes they made. And we should learn from them. So I sort of brought all those experiences together. And I think that was what led me to want to write the book.
Okay, so yeah. Graeber, according to the Anarchist Library, that came out in 2002.
Yeah.
Yeah. I read it like years ago, I think. But when I think of Graeber and we have this conversation about where Rojava is a part of it, then I think about Graeber's promotion of the organizing there as an interesting project. And so it's interesting. I wonder if he must have had reflections at some point where he was like, well, let me rethink this.
Because, yeah, I think he did, because like he went to Rojava. He supported what happened in Rojava, and like I'm to be clear, I don't see myself as opposed to his work, right? I'm a huge enjoyer of his work, right? And I found the way he phrases things to be really beautiful and in its simplicity. And I frequently turn to his work for understanding and his terminology, particularly find very perfectly well suited to what I'm trying to do, which is make these things accessible and not try and write like an academic. I think it was more that line of thought was not, it's not just his line of thought, right? That's not a unique line of thought. It's an assumption that many of us have made. And like, I guess the other thing is that it appears all the time in the Spanish Civil War literature, but everyone talks about the anarchists, right? When you read these big histories of the Spanish Civil War, and it's just like, oh yeah, well, the anarchists were over there, you know, or like, oh, huh, the anarchists managed to do very well. Oh, well, moving along. Like there's never a why or a how. Right. Outside of movement texts, obviously, things like, you know, and Paz's excellent work, for example. But like in the general histories, they just appear as this kind of closed box. Right. When we're looking at these big like Beevor's work and stuff. And even late in the war, you see these units after militarization, which we can explain what that means later. You see these things like, huh, like at this point when this battle was particularly gruesome, particularly hellish and difficult, there was this militarized unit of anarchists who were particularly effective or, you know, particularly courageous. And even if you're not interested in the movement, right, you've got to look at that as a historian and be like, why? What were they doing? How were they doing that? Because there's this received wisdom, right, that to be effective in conflict, there has to be extreme discipline with the extreme threat of sanctions and punishment for any breach in that hierarchical order. And I don't think they would do that. So how did they do it? What I became really interested in knowing is like that really specific, like, because I've been in situations of great physical danger. And, you know, I didn't, it wasn't particularly like the, like somebody who had a different badge to me telling me what to do, which allowed me to emerge from them safely, right? Like, and so I was very interested in how they had approached that, especially as a relatively ad hoc militia, right? Like not a militia that had been drilling for years and years and years. And I guess the other thing that I should add, sorry, I'm meandering here, but talking to this young guy called Zor, right? Zor Linthorn, this young fighter in Myanmar who I'd met because he was live streaming his combat on Facebook. And I was watching them fight. And I thought, like, this is remarkable, right? These young people are using homemade rifles to take on the illegitimate coup government of their country, which is one of the strongest militaries in Southeast Asia, which has aircraft, which has tanks, which has missiles, right? And these guys have in his case, right, they were making 22 rifles out of pipes. And they'd post little how-tos on their Facebook about how to make them, right? Because they wanted other people to be able to do the same, right? To liberate themselves. And so we started talking, and it was in that when he said, like, we don't really have anyone in charge. And then he described a process of what was essentially modified consensus, right? What Graeber would call modified consensus, where they someone proposes a plan and people can either veto it or say, I am opposed, but I'm okay with us going forward, but I want to note my opposition, right? But there wasn't even a majoritarian, right? Which was what one might expect, right? Even, you know, young people raised in the idea of like a neoliberal democracy might adopt a majoritarian plan of vote, but they didn't. They adopted a consensus plan. And I think their logic there was that all of their lives were on the line, so all of them should be part of the decision-making process. And it was like really not surprising, but kind of it dug back to that question I had about how they'd done it in Spain. And I was like, well, that's how they're doing it here. And these guys have very clearly not read David Graeber, right? Or Jim Scott or
Paz.
Yeah, right. They are doing this because it seems inherently the fairest way to organize. And they sort of have invented this consensus system from a blank sheet. And I was like, that's fascinating that these people who would not describe themselves ideologically as libertarian or anarchist. They're just young people who want to build a better future. And they have arrived at this consensus system because of mutual respect, right? Because of a desire for each person to be treated with dignity and fairness. And I think that particular conversation was a moment when I was like, okay, this is a human instinct. And this human instinct is one we can see in Spain, we can see in Rojava, we can see in Myanmar, and many other places where I haven't had the resources or means. And I think this should be documented because I think it's not something that's well discussed in the literature.
Yeah, no, that's a great way of addressing my question. And there's a bunch in there that I hope we can get to in more detail further in the conversation.
Yeah, happy to.
Also, so I guess like recognizing that some of these people that you document in the book do not identify as libertarian socialists or anarchists or any of these. Like,
yeah,
there's a strong, just to talk about anarchism, because anarchism is in the title. It's an anarchist publisher. We're anarchists.
Yeah.
There's a strong trend of anti-militarism and pacifist commitment through much of anarchism and the libertarian left, I believe, is a byproduct of the horrors of war experienced through the 19th and 20th century. Yeah. And maybe it's fair to describe these two concerns as overlapping, if at times distinct. Not everyone who is anti-militarist is a pacifist, for instance. I wonder if you could speak to some ways that you've witnessed the anarchist and anarchistic subjects of your work and reporting approach the question of war making and why left libertarians would choose these sorts of methods to fight.
Yeah, I think you're right that there's a very well justified anti-militarism, right? And there's, I mentioned this kind of in the chapter where I talk about gender, I think, where I talk about how the CNT did embrace a kind of militarism which I think was antithetical to that, and I think which has been rightly criticized since, right? This kind of hyper-masculine hero worship, and even like in some cases like medals and uniforms and things like that. But the way that the majority of people, and to be clear, like lots of these people wear uniforms, right? That's not necessarily a bad thing or a good thing. It's just a thing. And sometimes it makes sense, right? You would like to know who...
You wear uniforms at work, and a lot of these people had been in formations where they had met as co-workers, right? Or been in the same union, or already they were in formations, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And like often the stuff that they wore was the same stuff they would wear to work in the CNT, right? They would wear their mono, like their blue overall, became kind of their uniform, just purely from a, I don't want to shoot somebody who's pushing the same direction as me perspective, you know? And they that's why they wear the sashes and the union hats. But the way that they approached war making, I think, was interesting to me, because I think they approach it with, I'm thinking of reluctance is the right word. When I speak to young people, I spoke to people fighting in Myanmar 12 hours ago, right, this morning. I speak to them most days. I don't think they want to be fighting, right? Like, they've seen their friends die, all of them. Have seen people die. They've lost people they love. They've seen their communities and their homes destroyed. At least, you know, to my knowledge, we have, you know, certain people within, I guess, the world at large who, you know, consider war to be their calling. And I don't think these people do. I think they consider war to be a means through which they're able to defend their communities and increase the cause of human liberation. I see that in Kurdistan too, to a people there obviously have been fighting for a very long time, right? They have a long history, and it's a proud history, and I can see why they're proud, because the things they've achieved are remarkable. But I don't see that same, like, there's a pride in what they've done, but like it's a different way of approaching war making to the Western way, right? So like in the United States, people who fight are considered almost like a cast apart, taken aside from society and separate from it, and in some cases considered, you know, sort of superior to it in some regards. Whereas for them, war is a thing that their community is doing to defend itself, so everyone is part of it. I remember speaking to some fighters in Myanmar a few months ago, and I had just lost a friend, and I was saying that I was been speaking to that friend's mother just to try and be as supportive as I could. And they were saying, yes, it's very hard when someone passes away, and they always try and support the friend's parents as well. And I asked them where their parents were, and they were like, oh, well, our mothers have this position just behind the front lines, because when we casualty evacuate, this was a, I suppose you could call it, combat search and rescue team that go to casualties, or like a medical unit, right? They go to casualties and remove them from the battlefield, triage them, and then take them back to another level of care. And it was back at that, like, behind the front lines where their families would be providing care to these people. So, like, this was a community struggle in a way that it very rarely is in the United States, obviously, because war has not come to where we are. We have gone to it. And so they approach it very differently because of that, right? Like war is happening in their homes. Every bomb that drops in a place where they and their communities will live. Every landmine that is dug into the ground will be there until their grandchildren are running around on those same fields, unless they take it upon themselves to remove it, right? Which they very often do. So their approach is inherently different because of that. And I think, like, there are very reasonable criticisms of when it strays away from that, right? And when there's sort of a glorification in violence or a fetishization of certain, you know, aesthetics of conflict. And I think it's important to remember that, yeah, that war is regrettable. But I think I am not the person who should be hectoring those people who are out there seeing their friends die. They're very aware that war is regrettable.
And as you make the point, like, there's a difference between war being brought to you versus going out and seeking it and bringing it to someone else. And these are people in communities that are facing a military coup, whether it be Spain or Myanmar, or, you know, in Rojava, like, facing insurgent groups like IS that are proto-state, or the Turkish, like, SNA or whatever formations it happens to
be. Yeah, the choice to live a life without violence is one that they don't have, right? They can choose to resist in non-violent ways, but state violence is coming for all of these people, and they have a choice, right? Like, and the language that the state has spoken to them in for generations in many cases is violence. And in many cases, like, if you look at the young people in Myanmar, right, they tried to respond in the way that they had been told to respond, right? They tried to do peaceful protests. They tried to do funny memes so that the internet would, like, catch on, and then the world would care. They tried to appeal to responsibility to protect and the United Nations, and none of it worked, right? So they're left with very few choices. They have to respond to the state in the language that the state is speaking to them, and that language is bullets and bombs. And like, they went through this process in months, and they will articulate it to you. I've heard this from dozens of people, that they never expected to be fighting because they expected someone to come in on their behalf, right? The states of the world to protect them. The rules-based world order that they've been told was real, and it wasn't real for them, right? And so they had to take their own liberation into their own hands. But the choice to live a life devoid of violence was not on the table for them. It was either whether they were using violence too, or they were allowing violence to be visited on their communities.
I'd also like to know how you came across the situations in Rojava, and, like, the situation in Rojava, the resistance there, and the society that they're trying to build, and decided to go visit, meet people, travel around, cover it, continue contact. And same with Myanmar. I mean, you describe it in the book, but if you want to talk about, like, what drew you to cover these, and also, like, you had already been working in these, and so it makes sense to pull these topics together, but why these and not others, for instance? Like, these three have revolutionary horizons to them, and maybe, like, autonomy of action of the people that are partaking of it.
Yeah, like, there were other struggles I would have loved to have covered, right? There are parts... There are parts of Africa that I would very much like to have spent time in, but there's only so much money one can spend before they go broke. I would have very much liked to go to Ukraine. It just took a long time for me to get a visa, such that the window of time that I'd allocated to travel there had already passed. I have very dear friends who are anarchists who have died fighting in Ukraine, and I would very much have liked to have spent time with them in those units before they passed. I wish I had been able to go there. I would still like to go there. And just to sort of give a quick geopolitical overview, like, the future of Myanmar and Ukraine are not distinct, right? If Russia is strained in Ukraine, it can't arm the junta. And the conflict in Myanmar is about the state. it's not a conflict between two states. It's about the existence of the state. We could say the same to an extent in Kurdistan, right? And so, therefore, the states have stacked up behind the junta, because if people from... And it's not that there were pre-existing insurgencies in Myanmar since 1948, don't get me wrong, but if people can download guns from Reddit and liberate themselves, that's not good for Russia, that's not good for China, that's not good for a lot of other countries, right? So they've stacked up behind the junta there. So those examples were also interesting to me. Like I said, I came to think of the conflict in Spain in this way because I was interested in the way the anarchists had organized. Well, I remember I was very interested in writing about internationalists at a point, because the idea of risking one's life in someone else's war is interesting to me. And it's inherently something that people are interested in, right? Like this idea of the noble cause. And to be clear, not every international volunteer is fighting for the noble cause. I think, you know, there are people fighting for money, or this is just what they do now. There are many reasons why people volunteer. But a good number of people went to Spain because they thought that this was how you stop fascism, right? And I've written little bios of some of them, and I was interested in these people. But reading more of their diaries, I came across this pretty consistent thing where they'd go to Spain and they felt that there was a noble cause and they were fighting for human liberation. And then they were just under the boot of Stalinism, right, of Soviet communism when they got there. And that wasn't compatible with their ideas of human liberation and anti-fascism. And so I thought that, I was like, huh, well, you know, that's when I started looking at the internationalists in the Durruti column, right, and thinking, well, these people... It's a single line in the book, but like a lot of these people, the people who died defending Spain, like they live on forever in the memories of the people who appreciate their sacrifice, but also their passports live on forever in the Soviet Secret Service, right? Like in, where their identities were taken by spies because they had to hand their passports in when they arrived, right? So like it always seemed odd to me that the international brigades were cast as this noble cause, and for many of them it was a noble cause, but that what they ended up in was not compatible with that idea of advancing human liberty and pushing back against authoritarianism and state violence and all the things that existed in the Soviet Union as well as in Nazi Germany or Francoist Spain or fascist Italy, right? So that really took me to be more interested in the anarchist formations, I guess, along with my own political feelings. And then I guess I was interested in Kurdistan because we watched, right, throughout the 20-teens, this group of people confound so many of the things that we thought we knew about warfare, right? Like, oh, you know, you will still hear this, right? You can go onto Elon Musk's website any day and see people arguing that women can't fight in warfare for one of a dozen contrived reasons from people who, in many cases, you know, have never been within 100 miles of a front line. And we watched Kurdish women push back this disgusting misogynist movement, the Islamic State, right? And we watched them win. And we watched them center, like, love for each other and joy in a... Like, it's something remarkable, I think, to be... I remember there was one night in Kurdistan when there was a particularly heavy number of drone strikes, right? And I've been in situations before where, you know, you have to be conscious of your own safety. But we were all sitting around, like someone had bought a tambour, like a musical instrument, and they were playing. And someone had bought a songbook, like they had a folder, you know, like those ring binders with the plastic sheets and all these different, the music and the words were there. And I thought it was remarkable that after a decade of war, someone had been like, okay, well, we better not go out due to the drone threat, so I'll get my songbook and my tambour. And like the way that they still centered like the spontaneity and joy and welcome and friendliness, because war can understandably make people hard, right? And people can sort of shut off the part of ourselves that has the capacity for love and the capacity for solidarity even, right? And empathy. And I can see why. But it was remarkable to me that these people had done that. Like, I thought that was something really quite beautiful in such an ugly situation, right? So I guess it was that. Like, I can remember, you know, seeing images and videos from Kurdistan in the very early days of the fight against the Islamic State and just being like, huh, like, this reminds me of the things that I've heard about the Spanish Revolution in the early days of the Spanish Revolution, right? Like, the way that people were able to maintain the joy of liberation because they like in at the same time as like the horrors of war were visited on them, it was the first time that they hadn't been under the boot of an oppressive state. And so that was very interesting.